Blog Talk Radio.
Stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Hello, world. This is Pamela Elaine Lockridge, July 19th on a Monday, with the Stop Child Abuse Now radio show, scan 2706, sponsored by NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. Tonight, our special guest will be Talia Fletcher. She is from Clemson, South Carolina, and we're waiting for her to call in. Talia, are you here with us?
I am. I apologize. My self-service decided to drop just as I was trying to call in.
Okay. All right, sweetie. Well, we'll get to you in a minute. We're going to tell the mission statement of NASCA, and then we'll bring you on.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
So just
awesome.
Relax.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just relax. We have a good panel that's going to be here to support you. Okay?
Okay. Awesome.
All right. So we're going to talk now about the NASCA mission statement. First of all, NASCA is a nonprofit 501c3, and we do take donations to help us with various things like, having a webmaster and things like that. But NASCA is all about child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with two goals in mind. Number one, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. And number two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And I invite anybody that wants to know more about NASCA to go to our website, NAASCA.org. That's NAASCA.org. And let me give folks the call-in number to call in and be on our panel tonight. The number is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. Okay, so now we're going to talk about our special guest. We're going to talk with our special guest. So happy to have her come on tonight. And I'm so happy that we have a large panel here to support her as she tells her story. Our guest is Talia Fletcher from Clemson, South Carolina. And just to tell you a little bit, her family consisted of her mother, father, and three siblings. She was the third of four siblings. And she was abused by both her mother and her father. And I'm not going to tell her story, so I'm going to let her come on and begin telling her story. Just so she knows and everybody knows that what we'll do is we'll have her start with her family of origin, tell a little bit about that, and then tell when she starts remembering and when abuse started in the family. And we'll take her up to about between 15 and 18, depending on her story. We do the show in three segments, childhood into young adult, middle adult, and when she got on her healing path, and then any advocacy work that she's doing. So without further ado, I'm going to bring on Talia Fletcher and say hello to her. Hello, Talia. It's Pamela.
Hi, Pamela. How are you?
I'm doing okay, and I hope you're doing well.
I am. Little, technology snafu always throws me a little bit for a loop. So let me kind of get back into my headspace.
Okay. Well, this is a very laid-back show, and this is actually your show tonight. It will be recorded and archived for you to use any way you deem possible. If you want to put it on any social media platforms or you want to use it, later on, if you go to any conferences and you're a speaker, you could use your, and just share with anybody that wants to hear your story later on. So we're going to start the show, like I said, with the three segments. This is a 90-minute show, but you'll see that it goes very, very fast. If you get uncomfortable with any of the questions, that you don't have to answer them, you'll just say, I don't want to answer that, or I don't remember, okay? We have panelists that are going to be here to support you. They may have a comment. They may have a question. And like I said, you don't have to answer it. But let's try to keep the show. The reason we keep the show in chronological order is so that the audience doesn't get confused, okay? So if I stop you and bring you back, to fill in a gap, that's the reason, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Please do that.
Let's get started. Yes, ma'am. So let's get started. And what I'd like you to start with is your family of origin. Tell us a little bit about your family and then go into what you remember as your abuse in the earliest stage.
Okay. I grew up in what I would consider to be a fairly typical nuclear family. I had a mother, father. I have three other siblings. I am the third of four. The first three of my siblings and I were all about 2 years apart, and then my little brother is 5 years younger than I am. So, again, pretty typical. Nothing unusual about us from that perspective. I think I always felt like there was something not quite right. I mean, kids don't really have the words to describe what's going on in their families like I do now. Like, I have better language now than I did then. But I always knew that there was something wrong. Something wasn't right. And I think I was probably about 6 or 7 when I really first sort of was aware that there was something going on that probably wasn't good. I don't have a lot of clear memories. I have a lot of fragmented memories of my childhood just in general, but it's specifically around a lot of the sexual abuse that I endured from my father. And then my mother also abused me, but hers was more emotional, verbal abuse. Not as much physical, but my father was sexually abused all of us. But this is my story to tell, not my siblings. And also was very physically abusive as well. So like I said, I don't have a lot of details, because I think that my mind was working so hard to try to protect me, but I have all of the things that surround an instance of sexual abuse, except for the actual abuse itself. One of the earliest memories I have is my sister and I used to share a room when we were younger, and I was probably like 7 or 8 years old at that time. So she was 9 or 10, give or take. And we were talking one night, and we were talking about trying to stay awake that night. Every night we would try to stay awake so that we could tell our father no. And I remember the conversation so clearly. We were so, so adamant about trying to stay awake and trying to keep each other awake, but being quiet so that we wouldn't raise the awareness or anything or wake anybody else up in the family. So we were trying to be quiet and yet keep each other awake at the same time. And the next thing I remember is waking up the next morning, and I had no clothes on. So I always wore pajamas to bed, and I would wake up being completely naked. And I remember just hating that. I hated how I felt about that. I don't even think I could remember what was going on, which is frustrating, honestly. It was frustrating I would not be able to remember things. It's frustrating as an adult. Sometimes I'm glad for it. And then other memories I have are things like, you know, going out to get ice cream with my father, and I never got ice cream. I remember like him driving past the place to get ice cream, and he would say, oh, I guess they're closed. When I'm looking out the window, and it's literally like they're not closed, and I'm a kid, so like, you know, it's ice cream, it's summertime. Like, who doesn't want to get ice cream? And I'm like, they're not closed. And he's like, oh, no, they're closed. We'll just drive around, just you and me. And I don't remember anything until I get home. And then I run to my mom, who wasn't really a safe place for me either, but at least safer than that. And I run into her arms, and I'm crying, and she's asking me what's wrong, and I couldn't say anything. I think from a, you know, going back to that time as a child, and it was just, I had nobody I could trust. You know, my father broke my trust. My mother broke my trust. And so I really felt so, so very alone. But I was a kid. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't control anything in my life. I couldn't change who my parents were. I mean, and that I think is one of the most frustrating times. I got so frustrated being a kid. I felt so powerless. Like I couldn't do anything. And I had nowhere to turn. And I mean, this was early 1980s, and a family doctor, this is another thing that I remember, I had some kind of vaginal infection, and again, I was a kid, so I don't really remember what exactly it was, but I had something going on, and my mom took me to the doctor, and the doctor was like, they had this conversation, I could hear what they were saying, and I remember it just like he looked over at me and he looked at my mom and he was like, there's something going on. Like girls of this age don't normally get these type of whatever infection it was I had. And I just remember like thinking what, you know, like of course, like I think, you know, as a kid, I look back on that and I'm like, of course there's something going on. Like nothing is right with my family, but I didn't know how to say that. And this was before doctors were required to report these types of things. I don't think that occurred until much later. And so he never reported anything. And things continued on as they always had been. And it was just, you know, trying to lay low and not be noticed as best I could. But for some reason, my dad singled me out and like wanted to give me a lot of attention, which is like the most confusing thing because you want your parents' love, but being sexually abused, being abused at all, it creates such a confusion around what love is and what that really means, that even as an adult, it's confusing to me. Like, I can think about it in a different way now, but as a kid, all I knew was that love, like, wasn't innocent. And I don't even know that I understood that much, but I understood that there was something about the way that my father loved me that was wrong. I don't even know how I knew that. I mean, it wasn't like, this wasn't anything that was talked about. I don't even know if it's talked about nowadays in schools about abuse and sexual abuse or anything like that. So it definitely wasn't anything. I mean, TV wasn't like it is today. The internet did not exist. So there was no way for me to know that there was anything that was really wrong. I just knew it with, like, every part of my little kid body. Like, I just knew that there was a little wrongness there and something just wasn't right. You know, I mean, I wanted to escape that. I wanted to get away from that so, so badly. I thought about committing suicide. I was like 7, 8 years old. I didn't have a plan yet. I wasn't quite, I don't remember having a plan. I could have, I guess maybe, but I remember thinking, like, I just wanted to get out of there. I wanted to be anywhere but there. And then I couldn't even turn to my mom because I felt like after that visit to the doctor, I felt like she hated me that much more. Like I was about ready to like break some great secret about our family wide open for the world to know about. And it didn't happen that way because the doctor never reported anything. At least not that I know of, but it was still that trying to keep that secret and knowing that it was a secret and it just like, I had no place to turn to. So I withdrew within myself more so than I had before. And I'm naturally an introvert. So take somebody who's an introvert and you abuse them and it's like, they're just going to turn inward that much more. And, you know, I think that's probably one of the reasons I have so many fragmented memories in general is I just went within my mind and I just stayed there and I hung out there as much as I could. And I still have a tendency to do that in situations that are anxiety-inducing or, you know, anything that I perceive is a danger or a threat. I still have a tendency to completely, like, step outside myself. Disassociate, I suppose, is what that looks yeah. like. I forget words sometimes. So
that's all right. I do it too. Something about you say here, you were 10 or 11. From the time you can remember, you were 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm.
When you started really remembering it, is that what you're saying here in your bio?
I think when I was, let me pull that up. I think I really started putting things together when I was 10 or 11. I started reading and I read anything I could get my hands on. I was trying to understand what was happening in my world. So my father left. Like he got up one night, said he was going to go out and get ice cream, and never came back. And I was about 10, so my sister was 12, and that was it. Like that was, you know, at that point my parents had been married for 19 years, and to me it was, this is awesome. Like he's now left. And now my world will be good. It will be better. But it wasn't because my mother was still very much hating me. And so I started reading. I was trying to figure out what was happening in my world, what was going on. You know, I had attempted suicide at that point already. I obviously failed at that, which of course just made me feel that much worse about myself in a very weird way. And so, you know, my father leaving just made the abuse, the verbal and emotional abuse from my mother so much worse. She had to have somebody to,
Yeah, I wanted to stop you here. What was your father and mother's relationship like? What was the dynamic between your father and mother?
Yeah, it was a very volatile relationship. It was a very violent relationship. They fought all the time, verbally and physically sometimes as well. My mother actually attempted suicide and was in a psychiatric hospital for a while. And when she came back, it just made her more frustrated with him. So they fought all the time. It wasn't a happy relationship. She, you know, I think my mother, she is an extraordinarily intelligent woman who I think was in a situation that society told her that she should get married and have kids. I don't think that she would have actually done that. I think she would have taken a different path. And so I think she was such a miserable person because of the choices that she had to make by getting married and having kids. And she was very resentful. And my father, I think, was just a generally manipulative, narcissistic personality who wanted to control everything and everybody. And to do that basically would strip away everything about you and try to control you from that angle. So it was not a happy home at all.
Do you think your father had anything to do with causing your mother's mental pain that sent her to the hospital? Okay.
I
that
definitely
like
do.
It.
I mean, yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things, you know, it's like you like look back on your life, you know, like I'm doing now. And it's kind of like, wow, like when I was a kid, everything was so confusing. Like my mother tried to kill herself. Then she's in this hospital, we're visiting her in the hospital. Everything is very confusing. But now as an adult looking back on that, I can go, yeah, it was absolutely my father's mental illness with the narcissism and being a sociopath that led directly to that. Like I think she was much stronger than she ever thought she was. And so she was fighting against a lot of that. And it basically broke her. I mean, she went into that hospital, like it broke her. That dynamic that they had, which was horribly dysfunctional, and that's a nice way of putting it, completely destroyed the person that I think she could have been or was before that point.
And that's why it trickled down to you and the abuse you suffered at her hands. Talia, can we go down the panel now and see if anybody wants to make a comment or ask a question? And we do have a very large panel, so we're going to keep our question and comments very short. I'm going to go to Roberta in Oklahoma. Okay, Roberta.
Hello.
You're on with Tally.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hello. I'm Roberta. I'm in Oklahoma City. Yeah. A lot of what you were talking about is similar to some of the things I experienced. But I a lot of my memories aren't clear either yet. You know. So. And. But I just wanted to ask. Do you think there was abuse before your earliest memories?
Yeah, I mean, I think there probably was. I think that, you know, I read a lot still. And I was reading about how, you know, and if as a forming human life in utero, you and your brain is developing, the stress and anxiety of your mother can actually affect how your brain develops. And I think that there was so much turmoil that, you know, honestly, like, I think that there was, like, turmoil in me as a person, but then I think that a lot of the abuse was happening even before I ever, I could remember it or even put it into words, but yeah.
Do you still communicate with your family?
No, I don't. I don't have any communication with anybody in my family except for my older sister.
Well, thank you, and thanks for sharing so much already, and I'm glad you survived.
Yes, you are. We all are. Mm.
Yeah,
we will.
Thank you, Berta.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go down to John. John from Louisiana. You're here with
Hi, Talia. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing well, John. How are you?
Yeah, this is John from New Orleans. I'm a 45-year survivor here, and I run advocacy agency out of here and all over the United States and work with NASCA. And I just want to tell you how devastating it is to hear a story like this. You know, the only thing that I could ever wish for you in the future is that as you get older in age, that you could find a way to get past, you know, a lot of the trauma that came with that, you know, from your early childhood days. And I know that it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort from a lot of people. And that, you know, and I'm sure that anybody can agree with this, is that you can't, you know, do it all by yourself. A lot of times you think you can, but it takes a lot of support from a lot of people. And, you know, with NASCA and SCSA and some other places, that we're going to be here for you and support you, you know, as a family member. And we always will be. And we want you to know that, okay?
Okay. Thanks, John. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thank you, John, so much. All right, we have Darlene from Tennessee. She's an ambassador.
Hello.
Darlene. Hi,
hello.
You're on with Talia. Are you here?
Hey, Talia, how are you doing tonight?
Hello.
Hey, Talia, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm fair to middling, as we say over here in our region over here. Since I'm in Tennessee, you're closer to me when John's closer to Pamela.
Yeah, right. We're all in the same, like.
You are very strong. And the first thing that got me, that when you were saying, you know, when you were saying about your abuse, and then that your family was abused, and then you go, but I'm here to tell my story, not theirs. That's the same thing I ended up telling people. I go, I can't talk about their abuse. It's not my story, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I can only tell it from my perspective. I don't know what they went through. I don't, and because, as I'm sure you've probably experienced too, we don't talk about it. I mean, even my one that I only talk with my sister now, but she and I don't ever bring it up. We never talk about it.
Right.
It's that kind of elephant in the room, you know?
Yeah. It is. It's like, but you know, the thing about elephants, they always remember. So it's almost like, I wish we could remember more instead of just have the bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Because it would be easier to remember more of a memory than it would be little splotches, you know, to put the puzzle together.
Exactly. And I think it would have been, I don't know that easier is not the right word, but that's the only word I can think of right now for me to understand that it is my story. It was my, it is part of who I am, if I had a better memory of it, because it's so easy. Like, I had the opportunity to confront my father years ago, like 15 years ago, at least now, and he completely denied it. I don't have enough memories. I don't have enough of the details to have turned around to him and basically thrown those details in his face. You know, like I feel like I don't
right.
have enough evidence.
The things I did remember, like with my stepmom that she did that I did remember,
mm-hmm.
after I kicked her out, she came and visited me, and I told her, you used to dip my nose in cow manure, you used to do this, you used to do that. But she said, you never gave me trouble in your life. And I was like, then why did you do these things to me, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's like, I was just a kid. Like, why would you do that? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, but what we've got to realize is we need to stop blaming ourselves for the stupidity and craziness that they inflict upon us. I don't even
mm-hmm.
try to understand why they do anything anymore. It's just like, there's no excuse for abuse.
No, you're right. There isn't an excuse for it at all. You know, and I think it's almost like sometimes when I think about trying to figure out why, it's almost like I'm forgiving them, but I don't know that I'm ready for that yet. I don't know that I ever will be.
I forgive them, but that don't mean I want to be back around them. You know, you got to keep yourself
exactly.
safe.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
you
so true. Healthy boundaries.
Toxic people. Yeah, you got to
mm-hmm.
stay away from toxic people if you want to heal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You go back around the
it's
perpetrators
so
and you get more confused than ever, you know, because it's like, did they really? And you start questioning your
mm-hmm.
what your memories are and everything, and that just makes it worse.
Oh, yeah. And they do that to you. They, if you continue to communicate with them, they will continue to try to manipulate you. They will continue to try to control you in any way they can.
Yes, because they don't want the truth to get out.
Yeah. Exactly. And I don't know that they could emotionally handle that.
Yeah, the thing about it is, people, they got to realize, if you're too afraid about people finding out about saying things that you did, then don't do
mm-hmm.
it, people. Don't hurt people
right.
then. Because you know,
yeah.
you're so afraid you're going to get in trouble one of these years. Well, don't do it. Maybe do some good things for people where the people be able to say, wow, this one person was out of this world that really helped me and, you know, got me away from that situation, was so kind and loving and was the proper type of loving parent that we all kind of like need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish
yeah.
I would have had a parent like tuck me in at bed, you know, bedtime and all this kind of stuff and just a normal type of stuff, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to dream about being adopted. I mean, as in like I was somehow in the wrong family. And that somebody, and then suddenly this like wonderful family would come and be like, oh, I'm sorry, she was switched at birth or something, and we're going to take her back now, and then my life would be great. I mean, that was like, I lived for that, like that. Like, I thought about that all the time. There was also like, I was also like, okay, so if alien abduction is a thing, like, I'm totally cool with that too. Just get me out of here.
I get you there, girl.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Well, thank you so
thank
much
you.
For talking with
me. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Darlene. All right. We're going to get back to Talia's story. It's very interesting. It's very sad. Oh, hold on. There's Doug Silverman. Let me see if Doug, I missed it. Doug. Hey, Doug. Okay, Doug wants to listen. So from there.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Some people only want to listen in. And we were one thing I wanted to ask you, did your dad threaten you if you told? That's a common theme among people that are abused by people.
You know, I don't recall that he ever did that. I think that his MO was always making you feel special, making me feel special. So because of the relationship I had with my mother, I think he used that to turn me against her even more. Like, she wasn't a very loving mother towards me. It was easy for me to then turn back more towards my dad and look for that love and acceptance that I wasn't getting from her. And I think he, being the master manipulator that he is, I think that he used that to control me. So I don't ever recall him ever sort of threatening me or telling me, like, don't tell anybody. I think he used the fact that I wanted to be loved so badly against me. And he gave me that love and acceptance, you know, which is, I don't know. I was going to say it's worse. I think it's all bad. It's all bad. It doesn't, whatever they're using against children to keep them silent is horrible. But I think that, yeah, I think that my dad always used, like, you're my favorite. I love you. You're so special. Nobody will understand, you know, how special you are, only me. So it was definitely, like, isolating me and turning me away from the rest of the family. And I don't know do that short straw.
Yeah. Did he abuse your brothers?
I believe so. Again, like, I've never talked with any of my siblings about this, really, in any kind of detail. But based on some things that occurred with my older brother, I would say that absolutely he did. My older brother went through a period of time that he couldn't eat anything. The stress and anxiety that he had bottled up inside of him, I mean, he literally looked like a concentration camp victim. He couldn't eat. And what he could eat was very odd and specific. And by that, like, it was banana yogurt. Like, he could eat banana yogurt, but he couldn't eat strawberry yogurt. And, like, they took him to doctors, and they kept trying to figure out, like, why he couldn't eat. Was it something physical? There wasn't anything physically wrong with him. He would have these, like, horrific nightmares. So I absolutely believe that I wasn't the only one in my family that was being abused. It's just, I don't know for sure because we don't talk about it, which is definitely, you know, typical dysfunctional family. It's like the wounds are open and they're oozing, but no one's going to look at it and we're not going to talk about it. We're just going to cover them up and just, like, pretend like they don't exist.
Okay. How did you do in school when you were growing up? Did it affect your grades, or were you good at school?
It was a combination of things. I was a really smart kid. And so I didn't have to actually put in a whole lot of effort to be good at school, but it definitely affected my ability to focus and concentrate. Like, I, you know, didn't understand why people were worried about grades. I had other things to worry about. I had other things that, you know, took up my time, that I just didn't. School was kind of this thing that I went to and got a little bit of reprieve from being at my home. I think I kind of just skated through a lot of that stuff, and I wasn't an exemplary student. I wasn't the worst student. I just kind of was, like, middle of the road and just keep my head down. I mean, I think that's what I did most of my life, was, like, to keep my head down. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want anybody to notice me. I want to be, like, the smallest thing possible so that nobody will know I'm there.
So when you came home from school, did your mother hunt you out to abuse you, or did you have a safe place, a hiding place that you could go to get away from her?
After my dad left, my mom went back to work, so she wasn't home when we got home, which was really nice. So she ended up having to work several jobs because she hadn't worked the 19 years that she was married to my dad. And so luckily I didn't, you know, But when she got home later, she would typically single me out. And it was usually something that I had forgotten to do, as kids or kids forget to do stuff. And she would single me out. Or I got into an argument with my older brother, because when my father left, she placed a lot of pressure on my brother to take over that parental figure role. And I wasn't having any of that. I was that kid who was very rebellious and outspoken, and I would get into fights with my older siblings. And so I made myself an easy target, I suppose. It was easy for her to come home and yell at me and single me out, because I was typically I acted out a lot. I was so angry and so frustrated that I didn't know what else to do. And the fact that she was like, okay, well, your older brother is now your father who abused us. And I'm thinking, well, this is not a good situation. I mean, my older brother never, ever, ever abused anybody. He's like the sweetest guy. But, you know, he had that pressure on him to like make sure that everything was done so that my mom was happy. He was kind of the golden child. And so he did everything he could to make sure that the house was clean, that everything was taken care of, so that when she got home, you know, there wasn't anything that she had to worry about. But I usually messed that up. So it was she typically saw
me. You were probably trying to get back at her. You were probably trying to get back at her in some. You were probably trying to get back at her in some way.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I'm sure. Oh yeah. I mean, you know, when you have all of that, you know, inside of you, and the anger, just anger. I was so angry as a kid. I'm surprised like people didn't see it as I walked down the street. It was because I was so frustrated. Everything in my world was just abnormal, and I felt it. And I felt it on such a level that I didn't know what to do with it. And it just came out. And, you know, I really do look back on that, and I go, how is it that nobody saw my behavior and knew that there was abuse going on? How is that even possible? I mean, I look back on it now, and I go, damn, I mean, I would have looked at me as a kid and probably been like, something's up with that kid and that family and something. I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't have, but I still don't understand how nobody saw that, because normal circumstances, kids don't have that kind of anger and aggression.
That's right. That's right. So it says in your bio that your mother blamed you for being abused. So did she know that at some point, did you know that she knew he was abusing you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
How
I think
did you
when,
come to that?
So years later, like I was an adult, and she said it was one of the rare moments. I continued to try to connect with her and try to keep her in my life for a really long time. Until I realized that just wasn't a good thing for me. But in one of the rare moments that she had, that she was being honest with how she felt about things and how she interacted with me, she said that she was sorry that she didn't protect us against our father, because she knew. My little brother, who's 5 years younger than I am, she made sure that he was never abused. So she fought for him, which made us not like him very much, actually. He's like, well, how come you're fighting for him and you're not, you never fought for the rest of us? But she did apologize once, but I brought it up to her again, and she swears that she never said that. So it's like, okay, that's fine. I remember it the one time that she did say that.
Yeah. Well, she was only going to do it once. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was kind of like, I wish I had recorded that, because like, then I could replay it back and be like, I didn't just imagine that. Like, I didn't just imagine that she apologized to me and that she, you know, realized that she wasn't a good mother. She didn't have the tools to be a good mother. She didn't have She wasn't capable of it. You know, sad to say, she did not have the support to be anything more than what she was.
All right. Well, you went through high school, you graduated, and then you went to college. And you got a BA in psychology. Why did you go into psychology? I wonder why.
Well,
that's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, I know, right? It's like, why would I have gone into that field? I think I'm like a lot of people that go into psychology. I was like, I want to fix myself, but then I also want to help other people. Like, but to do that, I have to fix me first. I have to help myself, and I thought psychology was the way to do that. Just to back up a second, before I graduated high school, I left home. So I moved out the summer before my senior year of high school. I had been living on the street for a while and in my car and stuff like that, and I knew a very, very nice woman who was the first person to acknowledge that I was being abused by my mother. And she had a room in her house that she let me live in because I couldn't afford to pay rent. I mean, I was in high school. I was working 35 hours a week, making minimum wage, which at that time was like $4 an hour. So, I mean, I was happy if I could buy a pack of hot dogs after I paid for my car insurance and all that other stuff. But, so she opened up her home to me so that I could graduate from high school and continue on in the life that I have had since then. Yeah. So I think it was John who said, we don't, you know, none of us makes it through this alone. And that is so, so true. Like, I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for some of those, you know, those people like her along the way that really, that acknowledged me, that saw me, heard me, and knew what I was, had an understanding of what I was going through, and then sought to help me.
And where did you meet her at?
So we as a family, when I was 14 or 15, I think it was, we started taking karate classes together. I don't even remember how that got started as a family thing. And I met her through those karate classes. She had been in a very, very physically abusive marriage. And so she was, at the time, she was 65 years old, and she was taking karate classes because she never wanted to feel like she couldn't physically defend herself ever again. So she was quite the lady. I mean, she was a powerhouse, and she was awesome. So that's how I met her, and she observed a lot of the interaction with my mother and I. So she had an opportunity to kind of see us, like, interact together, and then she pulled me aside one day and said, your mom doesn't treat you very nicely, does she? And I like started crying. I just like burst into tears. Cause that was the first time anybody had really acknowledged that and said, I see you. I see the pain. I see what she's doing.
So you think God sent you an angel?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there is a reason I'm here. I don't know what it is yet. Maybe I never will, but I'm here. I'm doing it, whatever that is.
I did it.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the panel, if you don't mind. Yeah. Roberta, talk to
Hello.
Talia.
Hello. I just wanted to ask you a question. Whenever you were younger, when you were being abused, did you ever inflict harm upon yourself from being so angry or thinking it was your fault or anything?
Yeah, I never really, I didn't do, was your question about self-harming?
Right, inflicting harm upon yourself.
Yeah.
Not just physically,
yeah,
but even mentally, you know, thinking it's your fault, maybe, and you got so angry at yourself or, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I never did the self-harming. Like, I never cut on myself, but I used to hit myself. I guess that's the same thing. It's self-harming, Talia. Okay, I can admit that. I can say that. Like, so I would hit myself, or, like, I would slap myself or I'd punch myself. I would bite the inside of my cheek until I bled, until I like bit chunks of my cheek off. And I really thought that I had done something wrong. I really thought that I was a horrible person. I believed all the things that my mother said about me, you know, and that there was something wrong with me, that I couldn't be the perfect child for her, that I couldn't be like the kid that she wanted me to be. And I thought it was my fault. I thought that I had done something so horrible somewhere in my life, that it was, that I deserved it, that I deserved to be treated that way. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, that's awful. John, you're on with Tally again.
Yes. Hey, Tally.
Hey, John.
You mentioned about going to karate classes. Is that what you were doing?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's kind of irrelevant. I mean, it's amazing you talk like that, because I did the same thing. And I was actually going before my junior year at the end of my high school. And then on to college, barely. Like, you know, just, I mean, by the skin of my teeth, I'm telling you. And, you know, the people that I met in karate were probably the most, I don't know how to say this, unique people that I've ever spoken to before. And I use that for focus, you know, discipline in my own right, just to help me figure out what was going on with my life, you know. Even being an athlete, too, a high-regarded athlete, I couldn't find myself, but karate did help me a lot in a lot of ways. I even took it in college, you know. And
yeah,
but I could see where you're coming from with that, for sure. And where that led to, you know.
Yeah I think physical activity, just to add on to that, is really key in kind of working through, you know, because I was so angry as a kid. And I don't know if you went through that period of just being so angry and frustrated, but having that physical outlet was really just such a, and it still is, even in my adult life. I mean, I was an amateur boxer and kickboxer. And actually, when I went into the Army, I'm the 8th Army boxing champion from like a million years ago, but you know, yeah. But it's interesting.
I bet
that
you could still
throw
a punch if you had to, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I could definitely.
I'm pretty sure you could. And believe me, I'd be right next to you, okay?
Exactly. I'm like, you
well,
next to me, like, we're
you.
Both,
right
like.
Next to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, the other thing, too, that you were talking about, you know, when you first got into going to school and you want to, going to psychology, which is just par for the course in my eyes. I mean, for what we've been through, it's just kind of something that we actually were kind of brought into nature by accident. You know, I don't know how to look at that. But, you know, you mentioned something on there that really, you know, interests me, about you saying that you had to find yourself, you know, before you could start helping people, you know. And I agree with that to a certain extent, but I also agree that along the way, as you start helping more and more people, that you're going to find that you're helping yourself, okay? So you have to benefit, you know, from that objective, and use almost like a reverse psychology against what you're planning on doing initially, but it turns out to be the complete opposite, you know, which is the biggest case in a lot of our lives. I mean, it really is. So it's not for everybody. I'm not going to say it's for you. I'm not going to say that's what you should be doing. And I'm sure you got a bright future ahead of you, you know. But that was just a little insight from my side. And I'm sure that I know everybody here tonight, and they could attest that we are a lot alike. I mean, just hearing your story and what I went through and the way you live and your profession and everything you're doing, I mean, I could really relate. And I just hope, like I told you earlier, I just hope that you could be mentally strong for later on in your life and find a way to, you know, stay on top of things, okay? Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, John. I am definitely working very hard on that.
Yep. It takes time, believe me. It takes time.
It does. Oh, yeah. It is not an overnight thing, for sure.
Nope. And, you know, the only thing else that I could ever, you know, recommend to anybody, and that goes for anybody that's listening out there too, is that, you know, whenever you whenever you seek therapy or you see a doctor or anything related to any of these trauma issues that we all live through and have and will continue to live through, is that I would really recommend you bonding with, you know, that particular therapist or that doctor that you can really trust when they have empathy for who you are as a person and not just being a diagnosis, okay? Because it means so much more to me hearing the story from you tonight than it would be for me going to tell my story to somebody that I need to go tell again because I didn't like the last doctor, the last therapist. You know, see, this is therapy. I run a men's support division all over the world. I'm telling you, this is therapy for me in and out. And I'm so happy you came forward and told your story tonight because it's very intriguing. It really is. And I just hope that you have success in the future life, okay?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Uh-huh. All right.
Thank you, John. We'll get back to you, okay?
All right.
Thank you so much. Darlene, Tennessee. You're on.
Hey there.
Hello.
Well, John said that he would sit be right there standing beside you. I think I'm going to run away from y'all's legs.
Nah, you'll be behind us. You're that support, you know? Like you're the cheering squad.
Yeah, okay, I'm in the cheering squad, yeah. You go, girl, yeah. Show me it hurt. Can I?
Exactly.
Don't mess with her, y'all. She's training. Don't mess with him either, you know?
Right.
Don't mess with me because they're my security safety guards, you know?
Exactly. You know it.
Well, it is like therapy when we come and do these things because if you don't feel any kind of emotion when you come to listen to this kind of thing, you're at the wrong place because, you know, when you go through here and you feel the pain and stuff because you went through it yourself, but we are here to support one another.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is very therapeutic. So I want to say thank you for coming and sharing your story.
Well, thank you. I agree with you. It is extremely therapeutic, and I don't know that it ever gets easier to tell my story, but I will continue to tell it as long as it's helping somebody.
Yes. So I think you know what your purpose in life is sharing your story. Because it happens so
absolutely.
Often.
Yep.
You're right.
I agree.
Thank you, Darlene. We will get back to you. Okay, Talia, I wanted to thank you for your service in the Army, and you did go to Baghdad.
Thank you.
You were in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Yeah. My daughter's a Marine vet, and she was at, I can't remember, I want to say Desert Storm. Let me ask my husband. Hold on, he's on here. Mark,
okay.
What did Lindsay do?
She was in the same thing. She was stationed in 05. She was stationed in Djibouti. They had that terrorist surveillance camp, and that's where she was. She served over there, in that time. And I think it was 05 and part of 06.
Okay. Yeah. So she was in about the same time I was.
Right. Thank you, Mark. Okay, let's get down here, too. And then when you got out of the Army, you graduated with two master's degrees. Were they separate degrees or was it a dual master's?
So it was a dual program. It was, I was working on a master's in project management, basically a master's in management with a concentration in project management. And I was like, well, I could just tack on the MBA and get two degrees in 3 years. And I thought, let's just do that. I tend to be a little bit of an overachiever as a way to like prove I'm an adult now, but I still, like, I'm trying to, like, prove to my mom, even though I don't talk to her, that, like, I am not what she thought I was or am or who I am. So she never thought I would graduate high school. She didn't think I was going to be able to go to college. She didn't think I was going to be able to do any of the things that I've done. So I did get those degrees, and I'm very proud of the fact that I did that, because I was also working full-time while I was getting my master's degrees. And so it was, yeah. So, I mean, it was a lot of hard work that went into it, but a lot of it was I needed those pieces of paper to prove to my mother that I'm smart.
Girl, I think I did the same thing. I've got like five,
never believed
four
it.
Degrees.
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
Like 4 degrees.
Yeah, it's like we can grow older in years, but it's like, you know, you do things and you don't. And I'm glad I got those degrees. Like, I don't regret that. But it's like, wow, why did I really do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, at some point you got married. When did you get married?
I got married June. Yes, it was after the Army. I met my husband on his 30th birthday. So it was September 26, 2009, and we got married June 1st, 2013. And he's amazing. I mean, he has seen me at my worst. He's seen me at my better. I'm not going to say best because I don't know what that really looks like, but he's been with me on this, you know, process of just trying to figure out who I am. And I wouldn't be here doing what I'm doing, talking with you all right now, if it wasn't for him and the support that he has provided to me and the encouragement. Like, he has some meetings that he's on a phone call in the other room tonight. And before I, you know, he got on his calls earlier than I got on this call. And he said to me, I'm going to be on a call when you start yours. He said, but just remember this, you are an amazing person and you're going to do great, because you're so, the way that you tell your story is, it's going to help somebody else. So he's
absolutely
pretty awesome.
Yeah. I also have a person, my husband of 38 years. If it hadn't been for him and God bring him in my life, I don't know where I would be. I'd be in an institution, even though they don't have them anymore. I'd be somewhere. Anyway.
Yeah.
So
no,
at one point you start
those people.
Drinking.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've been drinking the whole time. I don't think there was a day that I started drinking when I was 12 years old, and I never stopped until 2 years ago.
Okay, and your husband finally said something needs to give, right?
Yeah, it was just before Christmas 2018, so it was December 2018, and I had been working a lot. I was in real estate, which is a job that has no boundaries, as much as you might try to put them up with your clients. There, it is a 24/7 gig, which I loved. I mean, I loved helping people. I loved helping them make, like, one of the biggest decisions that they will ever make in their entire life, and also the most money that they will probably ever spend in their entire life. It's a big deal. And was giving too much of myself and wasn't taking care of myself. And I was drinking much, much more than I think I ever had before in my life. I mean, I'd been drinking pretty consistently, like I said, since I was like 12 or 13 years old, as a way to just kind of try to numb the pain, to try to get away from it, try to escape, run from the demons, all that stuff. And it was at its point of, and I knew, you know, there's a part of me that knew it. I just couldn't admit it to myself. I could look at myself in the mirror and I would say, who is this person looking back at me? But I couldn't, I just didn't have the strength, I guess, or the, something to actually say, I need to change. And that day I had just had a really, I was yelling at him. I was very mean. And he's such a sweet guy. I was so mean. And he looked at me and he said, I can't help you. He's like, you need professional help. You are going down a path that I cannot, will not follow. So he's like, something needs to change. And I looked at him and I was like, I had that moment. And I don't know if it's not an epiphany. It's this moment where you want to look at this person who has just told you something that you know is true. I knew it was true in the very core of my soul. I still had that split second of saying, oh no, I'm fine. You're the one with the problem. And I'm so thankful that I took that moment to tell my brain to shut up and to not say that and to look at my husband and say, you're right, I do need help. And we were in South Carolina. We used to live in Maryland, and we were in South Carolina for the holidays. And I said, I will do the research now, and I will call. And as soon as we get back, I will have an appointment with a therapist. I will get on medication if that's the direction I need to be. I was like, I will do this. And I did. And I kept drinking. That was 2018. He deployed to Afghanistan in 2019. And then I stopped drinking. The last day that I had anything to drink was December 31st, 2019. It was New Year's Eve. I was by myself in my house. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to be around people. I didn't want to drink. And I knew if I went out, if I hung out with people, I would drink, and I didn't want to. I finally realized that the alcohol was not helping me. It was making me worse. Even though I'd been in therapy for almost a year at that point, I had to come to that realization and stop drinking.
So you got a therapist. Did you get a trauma-informed therapist that knew about childhood abuse?
Yes, I did. Yep. Accidentally, awesome. Actually, because I hadn't gotten, and I still struggle with admitting to myself that I was abused. It's a very weird, convoluted brain I have, you know, where it was like so many people denied my truth for so long that I started to deny my own truth. And so I'm still kind of working through that and just trying to get to that point. But I accidentally was connected with a therapist who does trauma-informed, and, like, she is, like, the greatest, she was the greatest, she's awesome. And I have a different therapist now, because when I moved to South Carolina, I had to change therapist, which I feel like is a horrible, horrible rule that we have around therapy and stuff. But my new therapist is amazing also. She's trauma-informed, substance abuse, everything. She's phenomenal. Had a therapy session with her earlier today, actually. And I talked about tonight. Because I said, I'm scared. So we talked through a lot of that and just, you know, because I said, I don't remember. I don't have the details. And I feel like that if I don't have the details, then was I really abused? And she's so funny because everything's on video conference now, you know, telehealth. And she looks at me and she's like, you know, that's not true. It's like, I know it's not true, but that's what my brain is telling me still. To this day, it's like, oh, it wasn't that bad. Yes, it was, you know.
Yeah. So I'm so glad you have a good therapist. How long have you been seeing her now? About a couple of years or?
So the first therapist I had when I was in Maryland, I saw her for a year and a half until I moved to South Carolina. And then I've been seeing the person in South Carolina for a year. Yeah. And it is, I think it was John who said earlier, like, you know, we don't go through this alone, but it is also very key to find that person that you connect with. I wouldn't be where I am right now in my healing process if I hadn't found the person that I connected with. And the first therapist, it was a happy accident, but it was an accident. I didn't know what I was looking for, and I was still hiding from myself. I was still hiding my own truth from myself. And when I called the psychiatric place in Maryland and said, you know, this is, I just need to talk to somebody. And this is kind of what's been going on with me. And they connected me with the therapist that turned out to really start me on this path. And when I moved, I interviewed people. I interviewed therapists, which I will tell you is a really hard thing to do because I want I'm such a people pleaser, which is a whole other subset of the abuse. I want everyone to like me, and I want everybody to know that I like them, and I want everybody to be happy. And, so it's hard to advocate for myself, but I had to in order to find the right therapist. Because I was seeing another therapist and she wasn't the right fit for me.
Right.
So I had to find
Yeah, you absolutely
change.
Know. You absolutely mm-hmm. know after a session or two that, no, this person's not going to be able to help me. You know, the
yeah.
way that they're directing us to answer or whatever, that you can tell that they haven't been through what, they don't have a knowledge of what you've been through, you know. Well,
exactly.
Let's go back
just,
to the people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a thought you wanted to finish?
It was also that, there's so many different therapists out there that specialize in different things. And I know that sometimes, like when I started out, and for those people that are listening, if you aren't in therapy yet and are thinking about it, you might not know what you need at first. But if you find someone who is a really good therapist, and they realize that they're not the right person for you also because of whatever has been uncovered in your sessions, then follow their advice. As hard as it is to leave a really great therapist, there might be somebody that will serve you better or differently, depending on the situation.
Oh, you said perfectly. You said that perfectly. That's all. Awesome.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to Roberta. We're going to go back down our panel one more time. There's only 17 minutes left, lady.
Wow.
Told you it would go fast, couldn't I?
I know. I was like,
okay.
An hour and a half.
Roberta, you're on with Talia.
Hello, again.
Hey, again.
hello. Well, I just wanted to ask, first of all, I just wanted to kind of comment what you said earlier about how, you thought you were going to be a doctor or something where, another family was going to take, help you out or something. You're
yeah.
in the wrong family or something.
Yeah.
I thought about that too, I thought about that too. I thought, well, God must put me in the wrong family,
Exactly.
I guess I've always had I kind of had a fantasy world, in a way, whenever I was a little girl, because I lived in my own little world outside of the abuse I suffered, I've always recited poetry, but I write poetry too, and I used to have this, I don't tell very many people this, but I used to tell this story a lot to myself. It was, once upon a time, long ago, far away, there lived a king, and then I'd kind of like put words to it, And mm-hmm. I guess maybe one time in my life I felt pretty safe and tucked in bed and everyone, but there was maybe one time in my whole life maybe, But, I just wanted to ask, did your abuse or anything or your drinking or anything affect you psychologically or physically in the military or affect your sleep or your performance in any way?
Yes, it definitely affected my sleep. It's alcohol is so insidious, I think, in that it affects so many aspects of your life, but it convinces you that it doesn't. It's a very sneaky drug. I would wake up in the middle of the night with like heart palpitations, sweating profusely. I mean, I would sweat through sheets, and it was, and I smelled like death. It's the only way I can describe it. Like, my sweat stunk. Like, it smelled like somebody had just died in that spot. Although it was me, I was still alive. And I think it did affect my performance in my job, in my career, in my relationships. I don't know that I knew it. I don't know that other people knew it because I'm so good at hiding things. I am so just phenomenal at, like, I will put a smile on my face and you will think that it is the brightest, sunniest rainbow day in Talia's world. And on the inside, I am slowly dying. And that's how good I am. And I had to grow up like that because I could never, ever show that there was a crack in my armor anywhere around anybody in my family, my mother especially. I never felt safe to do that. So I learned how to hide all of that to the point that when I stopped drinking and I told my friends, so many of them were like, you don't have a problem with alcohol. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I do. Like, I know I do. I was like, please look at my recycle bin, and in one night, I can drink 3 bottles of wine. That is not normal. That is not, it's not healthy. It's not normal. And, you know, just to kind of specify with the military, unfortunately, has a culture of alcoholism. People drink in the military. It is what we do. It is part of who you are. It is how you develop camaraderie and relationship with people. You go out and you get drunk, and then people have the stories about you. And it was rampant. So I fit right in. And it was great because nobody, like, looked at me and was like, you should stop drinking, because they were all out with me too. So it was a great place for me to hide and clean sight and to participate and not have anybody think that it was odd.
Wow.
So,
thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Thank you, Roberta. That was a unique conversation about the military. But if you watch TV shows and stuff, the military's always in their NCO place drinking, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And even when you get out.
Oh, wait a minute. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say when you get out, you know, like I was a member of the American Legion and the veteran of, you know, VFW, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and what do they own? Like those, every single one of those places, they own bars. It's how they make money. Like
oh.
It continues, really, yeah. So.
All right, I've brought John on with you. John, you're on with Talia.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, John.
Hey, Talia. Hey. Listen, I want to tell you, man, how impressive I am on the show tonight. I have to say that. I mean, looking where you came from and how far you've come, and I tell you, I want you to tell your husband that John Anderson said he's a man, okay?
I will tell him that.
He is the man, okay? And I commend him for being there for you left and right, because that's what it's going to – it takes that. And now you're at this point in your life where you got so much ahead of you, and this is where you're going to need that. And listen, I'm going to tell you, you know, that there's going to be some bumps in the road. You know, it's a wave of the way that all of us live our lives every single day. But it's all in you know, what you take from it each day. So
mm-hmm.
there's going to be hard days and there's going to be happy days, you know, so. And those hard days, if you ever have to reach out to anybody, we have so many people here that are available, you know, just to talk if that's what it ever comes down to. Sometimes it's the best remedy, you know. Other times exercise can be, art can be, you know, music. There's so many things out there that can help you along the way until you feel like that you've overcome, you know, some certain boundaries that you will going for, and I hope you reach those goals. I really do. And I'll always be here. You know, you can find me on through the NASCA site or SCSA or Facebook or anywhere. And, you know, I have areas too that I know people just like you, you know, that are just in the same situation you are and have
mm-hmm.
been, you know. But I can tell you that from what I hear, you know, in this enthusiastic voice that I've never met, my wife, you are definitely an inspiration for a lot of people, okay, for where you are today. There's no question, okay? And I commend
you
for that.
Thank
you
very much.
I really do. All right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, John.
I'm going to go to Darlene, and then we're going to have to end the show here in about 10 minutes. Go ahead, Darlene.
Yes, I was wanting to invite her also to, NASCA also has Zoom meeting support group, and it's on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern time.
Okay.
And tomorrow I happen to be the host of it. But anyway, it's on this front page, how to get there, stuff like that. And I want to welcome you to come and be a part of that family as well, because it seems like we all just, become a part of family. We're right here sharing one another, and we get each other's support. It does feel like a close-knit family. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I will definitely. That would be great. Thank you for
telling me
about that.
And when did you decide to stop wearing all the masks you had? That's a good question. You know that.
That's a really good question. I know. I was like, hold on. That's a really great question. I still wear that mask. I'm slowly pulling it down, but I definitely, it is still there. So it's, that one is going to be the toughest for me to leave behind, to like not use anymore as a coping mechanism.
Yeah, I think in a lot of instances still we don't want the outside world to see if we're upset or anything, so we'll wear a mask, when we go shopping or something like that. We don't want to show our pain to all these strangers,
Exactly. Which I think if you're out grocery shopping, I would definitely, me personally, I'm not saying that anybody else should do this, but I definitely do put a mask on when I'm out grocery shopping. Because I don't want to suddenly have a breakdown in the grocery store.
And I'm not just talking about the COVID mask thing, but I'm talking about the feeling mask,
right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, I had to wear a mask for so many of the things that I did, professionally in my career, because it was, networking and talking to people all the time, and it's exhausting for me. I'm an introvert, and so it was like, to put myself out there, it was like I had to put on this mask. I had to put on, this facade that wasn't real.
Yeah, and feel free to call me sometime, because I'm one of the ambassadors on the page, and plus I'm at Facebook under Darlene J. Clark, so feel free to add me.
Okay, yeah, I definitely will. Thank you, Darlene.
You're welcome. You did a good job.
Thank you, darling.
Thank you.
You did. She's done a wonderful job. Thank you, darling.
Thank you.
Okay, so just a couple of quick questions. You said your sister was also abused, but y'all never talk about it. Do you ever feel like, has she gotten any healing?
I don't think she has. I think she carries a lot of that inside of her. So,
yeah, and if they don't, I have a sister like that too, and she doesn't want to, try to get help. She's always denying it, so we can't really talk about anything triggering, because she breaks down. But you said, in your bio, you said we no longer need to stand or feel alone. What happened to you and to me changed the way our brains developed. The neural pathways that were created during our childhood abuse were designed to protect us. But we don't have to stay in that survival mode. It is possible to retrain our brains. How do we retrain our brains? And then leave the show with a nugget before we go. We've got 5 minutes left.
Okay. So I read a lot. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not somebody that specializes in that, but I understand that our brains develop and form throughout our lives. We've got two major sort of periods of growth when it comes to our neural network. And I think that the way that I understand, or how I'm doing this, is changing that old programming. So if I am encountering something like tonight, like this discussion tonight triggered a lot of stuff for me. It triggered a lot of that, well, what's wrong with you? It really wasn't that bad. You weren't really abused. It's not a big deal. Why are you still talking about it? It was so long ago. And I have to be aware of those voices. I have to be aware of that old recording that tells me that I need to continue to deny and deny and deny. And it's a coping mechanism that my brain developed a long time ago because I couldn't handle emotionally, intellectually, the things that were going on around me. So I, in talking with my therapist, we have come up with, I have statements that I will make to myself, you know, and like if, and they're period statements because I like to add things. I don't want it to just be like a period statement. I have to say like and or but or something. So, and it's, so tonight, for tonight, it was, your abuse wasn't that bad. I have to then tell myself, yes, it was, period. It was bad. And I just repeat those over and over again. And it helps to kind of reverse that thought process and how that was, you know, I mean, things change, like everything that occurs to us changes the way that we perceive the world. We can change the way that we perceive the world when we learn something new. And that's what I'm trying to do is teach my brain a new way of looking at things, a new way of looking at myself, a new way of looking at other people. And the only way to do that, I think, based on what I've been reading and what my therapist and I talk about, is to counter that with statements.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So leave our audience with a nugget tonight. What would you leave our audience with? To support them?
I think that the best nugget is we aren't the ones that should be ashamed. It, you know, we carry so much shame with us, adult survivors of childhood abuse. We think it was our fault and we feel badly for it. We aren't the ones that should be ashamed. Should be those that did this camp to us, be society that turned their backs on us. Those are the people that should be ashamed, not us.
Absolutely. And society's still turning their back against us, but we're not going to stop, are we?
Exactly. No, we're not. John and I are going to be there kicking down doors.
I'm going to bring John on right before we leave. We got 1 minute. John, you got about a minute to talk to Talia.
Oh, do I?
I don't
want to
meet you two in a dark alley.
No, not alone. But,
yeah.
You're speaking about not stopping. I need to let you know, and I know Pamela knows about this, that we just got the statute of limitations changed here in Louisiana, okay?
I know. That's
no,
awesome.
To no statute. And then that also gives everyone a 3-year window to pursue criminal charges too, which is a great thing,
mm-hmm.
You know. So, I mean, I've been fighting for this for 45 years, you know, and this original thing came about my case, and this is really not me. This is your night, but I do want to let you know that I've been fighting this since I've been 9 years old. And I'm not about to give up right now. You can forget that. I'm already, you know, getting ready to do so much for everybody around this world, including you, including children that are even unborn, you know. And I've already done that in Louisiana, but I'm continuing on. I know we got legislation action going on in Pennsylvania right now, which I have to get involved with because one of my guys that I support is heavily involved, and a lot, you know, depends on not just his case, but, you know, I mean, just everybody's across the board. You know, it doesn't matter where you were abused. It's just the fact you were, you know. So
exactly.
You know, the children need to know that they're going to have future protection, and that's
mm-hmm.
what it's all about.
Right.
Yeah.
All right,
I
guys.
Agree.
The show has ended. I want to thank our guests. I want to thank our panelists. And good night from NASCA. This is Pamela signing off.
Thank you.
Thank you.
'cause that dawn was